Good morning, and the mic is working. Monday after Thanksgiving, so we're a little slow in getting started this morning. Thank you for your patience. I'm Ted Pacone. I'm a senior fellow and deputy director for foreign policy here at the Brookings Institution. Welcome on behalf of the foreign policy program here to Brookings. This morning's event is part of a series of joint research and periodic updates on developments in China, sponsored by the Australian National University, the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences, and the John L. Thornton China Center here at Brookings. It is particularly timely in light of the high-level presidential-level diplomacy taking place these days involving all three countries, the ABC countries we call them. President Obama has recently returned from his first state visit to China. Prime Minister Rudd of Australia is in Washington today to discuss preparations for the Copenhagen meeting on climate change. And both President Obama and, I believe, Premier Wen Jiabao are slated to travel to Copenhagen beginning next week to personally convey their respective governments' commitments to reducing carbon emissions. So it is very fitting today that we take up two of the most important issues facing China. First, the issue of clean energy and climate change. As you know, the U.S. and China are the most important countries in the world in terms of carbon emissions. And during President Obama's visit to China, the leaders signed no less than seven agreements on U.S.-China cooperation in clean energy and made some notable statements about U.S. and Chinese approaches to Copenhagen. Both countries this past week have made important pledges regarding cuts in carbon emissions, though how significant these are really up to our panelists to help us interpret. The panel will help provide context on both what has transpired recently in the U.S.-China relationship and on what we should expect looking ahead to Copenhagen, but also more generally. The second issue is how China is coping with the global economic crisis. How is China faring? What changes are occurring in its own economy? And how will these affect and be affected by the country's international economic behavior? That will be the second panel this morning. And I'm very pleased that we have panelists here from Australia and China to join our group. And I thank them for traveling so far to participate in today's event. Thank you again to ANU and Chinese Academy of Social Sciences for their support for this series of meetings. And I'm delighted again that Brookings can host this event, and I'm going to ask the first panel and Charlie Ebinger, Director of our Energy Security Initiative, to come up and get going. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. Ladies and gentlemen, we're delighted to have you here today. As Ted was suggesting, these are indeed momentous days as we look towards the opening of Copenhagen and a little more than a week away. And we hope that China and the United States will play dynamic roles, obviously, at that forum, because without us both stepping up to the table, I think it's highly unlikely we'll see more than a process for further negotiations put forward. That may be what we have to live with, but we'll hope that there's still time to have more. We have a very distinguished panel this morning, and let me just briefly introduce them, and then we'll get underway. Our first panelist will be Ross Garnall, who is a distinguished professor at the Australian National University. Professor Garnall is a Vice Chancellor's Fellow and Professorial Fellow in Economics at the University of Melbourne, as well as a distinguished professor at the Australian National University. He is currently chairman of a number of international companies and research organizations, including the International Food Policy Institute in Washington and the Papua New Guinea Sustainable Development Program Limited in Singapore. In addition, he is a director of OK Teddy Mining Limited in Papua New Guinea, and a member of the board of several international research institutes, including the Lowry Institute for International Policy in Sydney, the Asia Link in Melbourne, the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Jakarta, and the China Center for Economic Research at Beijing University. He is the author of numerous books, which I won't go into, but he also has had a long and distinguished record as a policy advisor, a diplomat, and a businessman. He was the senior economic advisor to Australian Prime Minister Hawke from 1983 to 1985, and subsequently served as the Australian ambassador to China from 1985 to 1988. In September 2008, Professor Garnell presented the Garnell Climate Change Review to the Australian Prime Minister. This review, which has been highly noted, was commissioned by the Australian government and examines the impact of climate change on the Australian economy and provides potential medium to long-term policies to ameliorate these challenges. Our second panelist will be Elliot Derringer. Dr. Derringer is the Vice President for International Strategies at the Pew Center for Global Climate Change. He oversees the center's analysis of the international challenges posed by climate change and strategies for meeting them. He also directs the center's outreach to key governments and actors involved in international climate change negotiations. Mr. Derringer came to the Pew Center from the White House, where he was Deputy Assistant to the President and Deputy Press Secretary. In this capacity, he served as a principal spokesman for President Clinton and advised senior White House staff on press and communications strategy. He previously served as a senior policy advisor and as director of communications at the Council on Environmental Quality, where he helped to develop major policy initiatives. Before joining the White House, Mr. Derringer was a veteran environmental journalist as a reporter and editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. For nearly 14 years, he covered the 1992 Earth Summit in Rio and authored several award-winning environmental series. Mr. Derringer holds a degree in environmental studies from Haverford College, and in 1995 and 96, he served as a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Our third panelist, Barbara Fenimore, is the founder and director of the Climate Change Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Ms. Fenimore leads NRDC's 25-member staff in Beijing to promote innovative policy development, capacity building, and market transformation in China, with a focus on climate change, critical components of energy efficiencies, green buildings, advanced energy technologies, environmental law, and a number of other activities. Ms. Fenimore has had nearly 30 years of experience in environmental law and energy policy, with a focus on China for nearly two decades. She has worked in NRDC's Nuclear Nonproliferation Program at the Departments of Justice and Interior, and for the United Nations Development Program and the Center for Environmental Law. She has served as President and Chair of the Professional Association for China's Environment, PACE, and is the co-founder and president of the China-United States Energy Efficiency Alliance, a nonprofit organization. She holds a JD with honors from the Harvard Law School. So without further ado, let's get Ross Garnaut up to the podium.
It's good to be with you again. The ABC meeting on China, Australian National University, Brookings, and China Academy of Social Sciences. We put out a book each year embodying results of latest research on the Chinese economy, and the Brookings version of that will be out soon. It's not out for the occasion this year. We're meeting at an unusually interesting time in China's place in the world and in China-US relations. They're always interesting, but a number of things are coming together right now. Most importantly, the two issues we're discussing today, the aftermath of the great crash of 2008, which has left a legacy of continued growth momentum and confidence in China, and concerns about the growth outlook in the United States economy, and a very difficult budget situation as far into the future as we can see. So one of the things that the great crash has done is accelerate a tectonic shift that we've all been aware of for a long time, a shift in the increasing weight in world affairs of the big Asian developing countries, first of all China, but also India and Indonesia, and the relative decline in weight in world affairs of the old industrial countries of the North Atlantic. The acceleration of the shift could not have been more dramatic, and the panel will be addressing that in the next session. The Great Crash and the Great Recession had important effects on the climate change discussion. Globally, it temporarily slowed down the growth of greenhouse gas emissions, but not by much, and certainly not by enough to significantly change the rapid movement of the world towards high risks of dangerous climate change. The slowing gives us just a couple of years of breathing space if we take as our measure the levels of global emissions, but from some time in the future, like 2030, if we're plotting emissions growth over time, the effect will have only been to shift back a couple of years the attainment of various levels of annual emissions under business as usual. Even in the depths of the recession, emissions were still so large that concentrations in the atmosphere were still growing quite rapidly. Second effect of the crash on climate change was that it increased public investment in all spheres, and part of the stimulus programs of most countries, including China and the United States, included investment in emissions-reducing technologies. That was quite significant, and in the case of China, the period of huge fiscal and monetary expansion has been associated with quite large investments in emissions-reducing activities, and that's increased confidence in China that it can seriously change the relationship between economic growth and emissions and help to give the confidence that led to the statement by the Chinese government late last week. And the third effect of the crash on climate change outlook is that it made the political economy of taking action more difficult in all countries, but especially in the countries, the Western countries most affected by the recession. I think we'll be living with the overlay of that difficulty for some time. Just looking at three countries in particular, Australia, not because it matters so much on the world scene, but because it's quite an interesting example of management of climate change issues in the aftermath of the crash, with much in common with the United States. The United States itself and China. I'd highlight a few points. In Australia, we're going through a rather dramatic period. Like the US, we have a House of Representatives and a Senate, and government's position is stronger in the House of Representatives than the Senate. Like the US, we had a government until quite recently that at first contested the science of climate change and then was seeking to slow down international movement on doing something about it. That all changed in Australia a year before the United States in November 2007 with the election of the Rudd Labor government, which had campaigned strongly on the need to change climate change policy. It was probably the second main election issue in 2007, the biggest being industrial relations policies. And that preceded by a year, a similarly large turnaround in approach to climate change in the United States. The Australian and United States positions influenced them each other under the Bush and Howard administrations, and probably are continuing to influence each other. Prime Minister Rudd is in Washington today to discuss the approach to Copenhagen with the President. Today, American time, or Eastern time, and on Tuesday, Australian time, we're probably going to see a change in the leadership of the opposition in the Australian Parliament over the climate change issue. So we've not only had our first climate change election, we're about to have our first climate change change of high-level political leadership. All of this is rather dramatic in the politics of Australia. The history of it is the difficulties of the opposition parties, the Conservative parties, in coming to grips with the changes that have occurred under the Rudd government. Rudd came to power committed to introducing an emissions trading scheme and having Australia play an active role in international discussions on mitigation. This wasn't all that easy politically in Australia as it is in the United States, and for much the same reason. We're both economies with an abundance of fossil fuels, and we've developed patterns of consumption and investment premised on the availability of relatively cheap fossil fuels. Australia, the United States and Canada stand out as the three developed countries with far higher emissions per capita than any other developed countries, about twice as high as Europe, Japan, New Zealand. So there are plenty of interests that are threatened by a change in policy. The government doesn't control the numbers in the Senate, the Green Party, which is quite strong in the Senate, wants very strong action on climate change, thought the government wasn't doing enough, and the Conservative Party sort of wasn't giving enough assistance to high-emitting industries. And so Mr. Rudd's legislation was held up in the Senate. He finally made some concessions in the form of giving out more free permits to over-subsidised heavy-emitting industries and reached agreement on those lines with the Leader of the Opposition. The opposition parties are probably in the process of getting rid of him for accommodating the government's legislation. In the United States, you're much closer to that than I am, and I look forward to learning more about that today. But the announcements last week were, I think, historic. The President committing himself to a version of the bills which have passed through the House but not the Senate. That must increase the chances of something like that becoming law. I'll say a few more words about that later. And in China, we also had announcements last week, not accidentally, in the immediate wake of the American announcements. China was always going to show its hand more clearly after the United States had. It has committed itself to 40 to 45% reductions in the emissions intensity of production between 2005 and 2020. There's been a fair bit of commentary here about how that's not really much of a change, because China had been reducing emissions intensity at something like that rate anyway, and also it's not an absolute reduction in emissions. I think it's a very big change. In the first half dozen years of this century, Chinese emissions were growing about as fast as GDP. The energy intensity of output wasn't falling. The huge falls of the 90s which were the product of introducing pricing for energy and moving away from some of the processes of central planning had brought down energy use per unit of GDP. But that process had come to an end by 2000, and energy use continued to grow more or less in line with GDP early this century. The emissions intensity of energy use remained very high because of the dependence on coal, and it was actually a change in policy that led over the last 2 years to substantial reductions in the emissions intensity of GDP. I don't think the fact that China had already succeeded in getting itself onto a new path or diminishes the significance of it committing itself to continue on that path to 2020. For what it's worth, in my climate change review, it's published by Cambridge University Press last year, and it's on the web, gaunareview.org.au. I did some careful calculations of what each country would have to contribute if the world was to achieve the 450 parts per million concentrations goal that that the Europeans have for some time accepted as a reasonable objective of policy, and which Australia and the US are heading towards. What China is doing is substantially more than their part in the arithmetic that I presented in that review. The United States, on the other hand, with the 17% on reduction from 2005 by 2020, it is not doing as much as developed countries will need to do. My own view is that the rest of the world has to accept that as a reality. The most important thing is that the rest of the developed world, our country included, doesn't start to see the United States position as a norm, because we won't get strong global mitigation if it becomes the norm. We have to see it as an exception that the US, for its own political reasons at this moment in history, can't do much more than that. We have to see it as an exception and not something that we all have to weaken our own positions to move into line with. And I think that strong global mitigation is feasible within that context as long as we see clearly the position of the US. In the US, as in China, confidence in starting to make movement towards reduced emissions, in China's case first as a ratio to GDP and later on absolutely, confidence in progress will make it politically possible to do more. The mitigation of climate change has a cost. I estimated in my review, after the most elaborate set of long-term modelling of the Australian global economies, I think, and has been done anywhere, that the cost to the middle of this century to Australia of participating, playing its full proportionate part in a strong mitigation regime directed at 450 parts per million would take something approaching, but something less than 0.2 percentage points of GDP growth per annum off the total. It would delay by a few years Australia reaching the average per capita level, the income level that would otherwise attain in 2050. That all became part of the Australian debate, and people were prepared to accept those costs. We're probably making the costs a good deal higher than that and higher than they need to be by the way we're going about supporting high emissions industries as a result of the political process that's gone on. This is happening in all countries. All of them are subsidising trade-exposed emissions-intensive industries because each country fears that its trade-exposed emissions-intensive industries will become less competitive because others aren't doing as much on climate change as it is. And the net effect of this everywhere is to increase greatly the costs of mitigation in all countries. We need to use the reality of an emerging global agreement for all of us to get rid of this highly distorting stuff. And it's important in budget matters. The US, Australia, every country in the West faces a dreadful budget outlook. The US much, much worse than Australia's. Being able to auction permits rather than giving them out free to high emissions industries would have a material effect on budget prospects. It's how we handle this issue is not only important managing the big effort that's required on climate change, but it's going to have a significant effect on our capacity to bring budgets back into shape in the aftermath of the Great Crash. The US and China announcements last week, I took as being very helpful in the approach to Copenhagen. We would like both to have been stronger, but both do represent big shifts in position from a couple of years ago. The whole world needs China and the US to be taking strong positions if we're going to get a strong global agreement. And I don't think that we should use disappointment that the US, or for that matter China, is doing enough to as an excuse for the rest of us becoming less ambitious, because there's too much at stake. Thank you.
Good morning. My thanks to Brookings and ANU for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you this morning. As the theme for my remarks, I want to pick up on a word that Professor Garneau used a few times in his remarks, and that word is confidence, because I've come to believe that the ultimate objective of climate diplomacy, whether we're talking about bilateral summitry or multilateral negotiations, is to build and maintain confidence between and among nations. That's because I believe countries will ultimately deliver their strongest possible efforts only if they are confident that others, their counterparts, their competitors, are also delivering their strongest possible efforts. We all need confidence that others have the ability to act and are intending to act, and once they've committed to a set of actions, we need confidence that, in fact, they are fulfilling those commitments. And this is something of a virtuous circle, because we need greater confidence to get us to agreements, and then hopefully good agreements deliver greater confidence in turn. And I think it's reasonable to argue that one of the greatest obstacles to achieving global progress on the issue of climate change has been a lack of confidence, in particular between these two countries, the United States and China. As we all know, in Washington, there has been longstanding concern here in this town, certainly going back to the days of the Kyoto negotiations, that China could not be counted on to do its part, and many have argued on that basis that the U.S. should hold off on enacting mandatory greenhouse gas controls here. For its part, the United States has probably provided plenty of reason for a lack of confidence in our efforts. First, the U.S. having walked away from the Kyoto Protocol. Second, still not to date having enacted any mandatory controls on our greenhouse gas emissions. And within the bilateral context, there's a long history of the U.S. helping to launch but then abandoning joint initiatives. And I think this has periodically eroded whatever trust had begun to be built between the United States and China on these issues. At this point, though, I think we can point to a number of very promising signs that, in fact, we are seeing confidence being built, and I would start with the recent summit in Beijing. Climate change in the context of this summit was a point of agreement rather than disagreement. Was one of the points of agreement highlighted by the leaders. Many of the concrete outcomes of the summit were energy and climate related. The joint statement from the two leaders contained some very important language on the issue. Both countries resolved to take strong mitigation actions, and the two sides said that they resolve to stand behind these commitments. Important words, I think, coming from the leaders of the world's two largest greenhouse gas emitters. Together, they launched a series of joint initiatives on clean energy, electric vehicles, efficiency, coal, other areas of clean energy. And I think we can look to those to be producing some concrete results over time that, in fact, will better enable both countries to tackle these issues. But importantly, I think they also do provide opportunities to continue to build and strengthen confidence in areas such as technology sharing, which are probably more practically approached in the context of specific initiatives rather than in a broad, complicated negotiation. And I would point in particular to a memorandum of understanding achieved between the U.S. EPA and NDRC with the goal of strengthening capacity for greenhouse gas emission inventories. That, of all the initiatives launched at the summit, I think that is the one that probably speaks most directly to the issues in the global negotiations. So I think the bottom line on the summit is that while it may not have achieved any fundamental breakthroughs from the perspective of confidence building, it was certainly a success. But the summit, of course, has already been overshadowed by what came next, the two countries putting numbers on the table. Something the U.S. has not done since the Kyoto negotiations, and something China, frankly, has never done. In the case of the U.S., President Obama has proposed a provisional target in the range of 17% below 2005 by 2020. In the case of China, what we have heard is a voluntary goal to reduce carbon intensity 40 to 45% in the same time frame. Now, each is saying that the other's offer is not enough. Many others have expressed disappointment in both, but I think the fact that the two largest emitters now have numbers on the table is, in fact, a sign of greater confidence on both sides and is a major step forward. And I think it should give us all greater confidence because a global agreement, frankly, is only possible with these two participating, and numbers on the table is a critical step in that direction. But ultimately, I think the real test is what we can achieve multilaterally. Ultimately, what we need are binding commitments from all the major economies. And I think the question for Copenhagen is how far it can move us toward that objective. I would foresee the outcome in Copenhagen in two broad dimensions. The first being a set of political commitments. These are individual commitments from the major countries on the types of mitigation actions they intend to undertake. And these are also financial commitments from the developed countries to provide some prompt start support, some upfront support to developing countries, both on climate mitigation and on climate adaptation. But again, I want to be careful to characterize these as political commitments. The second major dimension of what I hope to see in Copenhagen would be a start on the architecture of a future treaty, because what we are seeing now is basically a two-step process. We are seeing a political agreement in Copenhagen that hopefully sets the stage for a legal agreement to be achieved next year. And if we're going to get to that second step, that legal agreement, it's important that parties in Copenhagen make some real progress on beginning to lay down the architecture. How are commitments going to be defined in this treaty? What is the longer-term financial architecture to provide sustained, reliable support to developing countries? And importantly, how are countries' commitments going to be verified? And that, I think, maybe is the element most critical to instilling and maintaining confidence among parties and in the agreement itself. The question is, how confident can a country be that others will do and are doing what it is they've promised? Now, the Bali Action Plan, which was adopted by governments in 2007 and framed the current negotiations, contained an important phrase: measurable, reportable, and verifiable. This was a new construct introduced into the climate negotiations, and parties agreed at that point that their mitigation actions are to be verifiable. That, I think, holds the potential to provide the kind of confidence we need. But as we get closer to Copenhagen, we see that many parties are, to one degree or another, retreating from this concept of verification. China last week reiterated its view that verification should apply only to actions that are supported by the international community, not to actions that a country like China takes on its own. And, of course, in the case of China, most of the actions that we would expect to see would be taken on its own, not supported by the international community. The United States, for its part, doesn't use the word verification in its proposal on MRV, MRV being the lingo we've developed for measurable, reportable, and verifiable. So the U.S. has tabled an MRV proposal that manages to avoid using the word verification. The proposal has a number of very important features. It would require annual greenhouse gas inventories from all the major emitting countries. It would require that they submit regular reports on their implementation of the actions that they've agreed to. It would require that both the inventories and these implementation reports be subject to expert review at the international level. All of these are important steps toward greater transparency. But the U.S. proposal only goes so far as requiring a peer review process. So at the end of this review process, in an open plenary of all parties, the party concerned makes a presentation on what it's doing, how it's implementing its actions, and other parties have the opportunity to comment or ask questions on that. Again, a step toward transparency, but one could easily see this evolving into a very polite ritual in which countries tacitly agree not to be too harsh with one another. And I think at best what you get is an inconclusive debate with a party claiming that it's in full compliance and other parties disagreeing. And this effectively leaves the question of compliance entirely to domestic compliance regimes. And my sense is that many in Congress, would be quite confident of domestic compliance regimes here in the United States, but perhaps not as confident of domestic compliance regimes in other countries, including China. So what you wind up with is an asymmetry or a perceived asymmetry that I don't think goes far enough to provide the kind of confidence we need. From our perspective, an agreement would need to establish some means to independently determine if a country is complying with its commitments. This could be done through some type of implementation committee appointed by the parties to look at the reports from the expert review panels and any submissions from parties and render a judgment. Is a country complying with its commitments? We would not suggest that this be a punitive approach, one involving penalties necessarily. I think that's something that many countries, including China and quite possibly the United States, would not accept. Rather, we would suggest what is termed a facilitative approach, a compliance mechanism that is geared toward helping to identify and overcome obstacles to implementation so that countries that are not in compliance can help be brought back into compliance. There's a well-established school of thought in international law that naming and shaming may well be the most powerful incentive for compliance. That the potential threat of international censure and the reputational costs that would entail is the most powerful force available to the international community to encourage parties to fulfill their commitments. But for effective shaming, you need effective naming, which is why we think that you do need some mechanism in an agreement to actually reach that clear determination of compliance or noncompliance. So in sum, let me just say that I think we are seeing some very, very encouraging signs of progress. Even if the numbers put forward by the U.S. and China fall short of what many had hoped or expected, they are, in fact, major steps forward. And they open the way toward building an effective multilateral climate regime. I think we should be watching in Copenhagen to see just how far we get toward building a solid architecture so that Copenhagen isn't simply a pledging conference, but that it in fact moves us closer to a full agreement that gives parties real confidence by providing clarity on commitments and on compliance. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you to the Brookings Institute for inviting me to speak today. We're coming off an exciting few weeks of U.S.-China negotiations and discussions on climate change. And I want to spend my time here today covering a little more detail of what's happened in the last couple of weeks, the significance of the partnerships and commitments that have been announced, and what we can look for from the U.S. and China in the Copenhagen negotiations and afterwards. One of the key achievements of President Obama's Asia trip was that it advanced the discussions on climate and collaboration in clean energy with China, and it laid the foundation for future concrete and meaningful cooperation that hopefully will build trust between the countries and accelerate the development of clean energy deployment. The key principle here is engagement and partnership. No country can address the challenge of climate change alone, and it's especially necessary for the major emitting countries, particularly the U.S. and China, the world's two largest emitters, to find ways to cooperate on the policy and technology developments that are required to shift to a low-carbon economy. Reducing emissions from fossil fuels will require the development and deployment of clean energy technologies on a very large scale. And the U.S. and China both have strengths, complementary strengths, in innovation, design, and manufacturing that will be vital to building this new energy economy. You heard that in China, Presidents Obama and Hu announced a package of clean energy initiatives in the key areas that are vital to developing the technological solutions for reducing emissions. And they're mutually beneficial for both countries, and they can speed the transition to a clean energy economy. So I'd just like to highlight in a little more detail some of these initiatives and comment on their substance. The first is the Energy Efficiency Action Plan, which we believe is key to achieving the levels of carbon intensity reduction and absolute carbon emissions that the two countries have recently pledged. And they have pledged to work together on some of the areas of greatest potential reductions through energy efficiency, including developing building efficiency codes and building energy rating and labeling systems, benchmarking industrial energy efficiency, and harmonizing the test procedures and the performance metrics for energy efficiency, energy efficient consumer products, and exchanging best practices and demonstrating these design and energy practices. There will also be an annual U.S.-China Energy Efficiency Forum and a Mayor's Sustainable Cities Program, and where local officials can visit each other's cities to share experiences and best practices. We believe, and many, many analyses have shown, that energy efficiency, which means getting more work done from the same amount of energy, is key, a vital part of mitigating emissions. And it's the cheapest, cleanest, fastest way to reduce any country's emissions while saving money. From the U.S. side, over the past several decades, California has become a leader in energy efficiency, and its experience has shown that every dollar invested in energy efficiency leads to $3 in energy savings. But still, there's enormous untapped potential for energy efficiency in both countries. These energy efficiency measures alone in China are capable of reducing China's carbon emissions by 728 million tons by 2020, more than any of the other abatement sources combined. Yet, investment in energy efficiency in China is only 5% of the investment that it's making in supply-side energy resources. So the high energy consuming sectors account for over 70% of China's industrial energy use, but they only contribute 20% to the value added. So therefore, these agreements, this Energy Efficiency Action Plan, we feel is going to be a vital step in moving forward, increasing investments in energy efficiency and therefore reductions in both countries. Second, the two countries agreed to a renewable energy partnership. They're going to develop and implement policies to advance renewable energy deployment in both countries through renewable energy road mapping, regional deployment solutions, advanced R&D, and public-private engagement. The U.S. and China were the two countries in the world who invested the most in renewable energy last year. And they're the world's leaders in the design, the manufacture, and the installation of various technologies in renewable energy. this cooperation is going to scale up that investment, that R&D, to the level necessary to take advantage of their competitive advantages in a way that benefits both countries. There will also be an advanced grid working group to bring together U.S. and China policymakers and regulators, leaders, and civil society to develop strategies for grid modernization. This is key to enable renewable energy to enter the grid in both countries. There's a new U.S.-China electric vehicle initiative. This is of particular interest to the leaders in both the Department of Energy and the Ministry of Science and Technology. This is going to accelerate electric vehicle development through joint product and testing standards, development of a roadmap to identify the R&D needs, and barriers to widespread use of electric vehicles, which still exist in both countries. This is important because China and the U.S. are the world's largest consumers and manufacturers of vehicles. And electric vehicles are a key way for both countries to reduce their reliance on oil. China's projected to increase the number of cars by 10 times from its current level by 2025. While the U.S. transport sector is responsible for a third of all CO2 emissions, so this could not be more important. And finally, the U.S. and China agreed to cooperate on a 21st century coal initiative, which includes several measures designed to further the rapid commercialization of carbon capture and sequestration and to develop cooperation on shale gas initiative. And finally, as was mentioned earlier, we believe it's key that both the U.S. and China, the EPA and the NDRC, China's most powerful government agency, agreed to cooperate on development of greenhouse gas inventories. This is the first time that EPA has partnered with the NDRC, which is responsible for all climate change activities. And it's going to help develop the cooperation on the key issue of monitoring, reporting, and verification. So while China has not agreed to allow international verification of its emissions, this kind of cooperation gets us a step closer to that goal. China has already developed an inventory of its greenhouse gas emissions. Back in 2004, it's developing its second one right now. And it's made it clear that it's going to include its carbon intensity target as part of its climate policy, part of its medium to long-term social and economic development plans. And they're going to probably allocate this carbon intensity target down to the provincial and local level. So again, active engagement between the U.S. and China here on the details of its greenhouse gas inventory design is going to be key to enhancing the confidence between both countries. So what are the expectations that we see for both China and the U.S. As they go to Copenhagen? You've heard the announcements. Everyone's heard the targets that both countries have recently adopted. But I think it's important to note that China's new carbon intensity announcement is significant not only because of the actual number of the target, but because of the national monitoring framework that will accompany it at the domestic level. China has already announced that it will establish a national greenhouse gas database management system. And we expect this to follow, in essence, the framework that it's already developed over the last five-year plan for monitoring, reporting, and verifying its progress in meeting its energy intensity target. This includes things like, in September 2008, the establishment of a National Bureau of Energy Statistics, a Department of Energy Statistics within the National Bureau of Statistics, which is creating a nationwide system for monitoring and verifying its energy statistics and determining compliance with this very important target. And that is not just at the national level, but the local governments have also improved their institutional arrangements for monitoring and verifying their energy intensity compliance and their staffing to do so. And on the carbon intensity target, China has already required every province to develop its own climate change action plan and to set up a climate change leading group led by the governor of each province. or the mayor of provincial-level cities, such as Beijing and Shanghai. This is going to be key in determining compliance with these targets and in enabling them to take place. You need leadership at both the national level and the local government level. China just yesterday announced, issued a progress report on how well it has been meeting its commitments in its climate change action plan to date. And it's 100 pages. It's quite comprehensive. And it's clear to me from reading this progress report that China's climate change efforts have been going on for some time and have been quite comprehensive in everything from forestation to energy efficiency and renewables. So neither country is going to be entirely satisfied with the commitments made by the other, but both should realize, and I think our earlier speakers agreed, that they represent a significant commitment given the particular situation in each country. China would like to see the U.S. and other developed countries commit to a reduction of 40% by 2020 from 1990 levels. The U.S. commitment of a 17%, in the range of 17%, from 2005 levels is equivalent to only a 4% reduction from 1990 levels. But it does represent, or there are plans in the Waxman-Markey bill to accelerate that as the years go by. On the U.S. side, they would like to see China set a slightly higher target for reducing its carbon intensity so that China's absolute emissions can begin to slow and peak as soon as possible, preferably by something around 2025. But we need to remember that China is both a developing country and a rapidly growing economy. And so as it constructs the infrastructure and buildings to house its increasingly urban population, that is by its very nature going to increase its carbon emissions. But China should be given credit for the significant actions that it has already taken to, in the current five-year plan, to improve its energy intensity. As you may recall, the commitment was to reduce its energy use per unit of GDP by 20% between 2005 and 2010. And it's already, at the end of 2008, gotten halfway to that goal, reduced its energy intensity by 10%, which corresponds to absolute emission, carbon emission reduction of 670 million tons. And if it does achieve its target by 2010, and I should say that this past year it was over the average of 4%, so its efforts are accelerating. We would expect to see a reduction in CO2 emissions from this one measure of something along the lines of 1 billion tons of CO2 emissions. So it's important, as our earlier speakers have said, to recognize the actions that China has already taken that are quite significant. With regard to the Copenhagen summit as a whole, I believe it's possible to come to a meaningful framework agreement, sometimes called an operational accord, that will include the commitments of each of the major emitting countries with respect to their mitigation actions and how they will contribute to addressing their emissions. And there will also likely be all of the other key elements that we believe are necessary to make that framework meaningful, including agreements on the funding needed to assist the most vulnerable, least developed countries in adapting to climate change and to strengthen forestation efforts around the world. So the declaration by President Obama and other world leaders at the APEC meeting recently in Singapore that they did not believe it would be possible to come to a fully binding legal agreement in Copenhagen in December, but that they would strive to achieve a meaningful operational agreement with all the major components of an agreement laid out was a realistic assessment of the current situation. Should not prevent us from coming to a meaningful, legally binding international agreement in the first half of 2010 or by the next climate meeting in December 2010 at the very latest. This additional time should allow the U.S. Senate to debate and consider climate legislation, which, if and when passed, will demonstrate the United States' full commitment and leadership to implementing the policies necessary to cap and reduce our emissions, and form the basis for strengthened commitments by other countries as part of a final climate agreement in which all countries are fairly contributing to the global effort to address climate change. Thank you very much.
We've had three very interesting presentations. And just to get us started, I'd like to throw out, since I didn't hear any of the panelists mention as part of the architecture that we hope emerges from Copenhagen, what you think can be accomplished or what needs to be accomplished on the issue of intellectual property protection. Since it's fine to talk about all the government-to-government agreements we've made, but in reality, we all know that most of the technology that's going to help ameliorate or mitigate climate change is really going to come from the private sector. So if anyone would like to address that issue and what we can expect either a Chinese position or an American position to be on that, we can start there and then open it to the floor.
I'm happy to get us started. My expectation is that a Copenhagen agreement may say little or nothing at all on the question of intellectual property rights. It certainly has been an issue in the negotiation with the G77 countries, the developing country bloc, calling for measures such as compulsory licensing to provide easier access to intellectual property, but with some very strenuous resistance to such ideas coming from the United States and Europe and other developed countries. Given how far apart the parties are on that issue, my expectation is that it's not something they can come to agreement on in Copenhagen, nor do I think it's necessarily something that needs to be directly addressed at this stage in a climate agreement. I think that if we look at the types of technology transfer that are needed and the types of technology transfer that are taking place already, technology is indeed transferring through conventional commercial channels. It's the transfer of technology that has enabled both China and India to become world leaders in renewable energy technologies. And this was not done through any form of compulsory licensing, but rather through commercial arrangements. And we do have established multilateral fora for addressing issues of intellectual property when that's necessary. I think it's more appropriate to leave the issue in the WTO for now, unless there's a really demonstrated need to take it up within the climate context. I think at this point, a new funding mechanism to help transfer technology really is the critical need. I mean, something that will help transfer existing technologies, many of things that are on the shelf now that aren't being deployed that can have some immediate impact. And we can do that without having to renegotiate the terms of intellectual property.
Anybody else want to add anything?
Yes, I would agree with that. Intellectual property is a WTO issue, not a UNFCCC issue. It's been being handled elaborately within a WTO framework. There is a need as part of the set of agreements that we need to reach on climate change to have a commitment for high-income countries to invest public resources in research, development, and commercialization of new technologies. Jagdish Bhagwati at Columbia has suggested to the Indian Prime Minister that can be a way of handling the issue of historical responsibility that developing countries attach a lot of importance to, we need a lot of innovation very quickly to lower the cost of the transformation that has to be made. There are externalities in research, development, and commercialization of new technologies, so there need to be public resources in it, and I think high-income countries should be committing each to make sure that they're putting adequate resources into research, development, and commercialization. There's a need at the research end, where research in the nature of things is has to be a public good, and at the commercialization end, where you generate private property. International commitment to expenditure on research, development, commercialization could include a component for paying for the utilization of privately developed technology in developing countries.
Okay, the floor is open. Would you please, before asking your question, identify yourself and your organization, please? Any questions from the floor? Yes, sir. There are mics coming, if you'll wait just a minute.
I'm Eric McVeigh, the Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. I've been sitting here thinking big thoughts. You certainly made me feel encouraged. I was in China just before the Obama visit, and then I was disappointed to see that there were so many critical press reports. It seems to me that maybe some good things did happen. I was thinking and scribbled down a few things that I'm seeing: U.S.-China cooperation on North Korea, the climate, the global economic crisis, the Gulf of Aden situation. Yes, there are a lot of other unanswered questions with currency and IPR and Taiwan and human rights, and I could rattle on for a minute. But it seems to me the way we're handling things is one of the most important things you may have said this morning is how China and the U.S. are approaching some sort of partnership in this century. I wonder if you think I'm being too grand and thinking big thoughts.
Anybody?
I would definitely agree with you. There were a lot of issues on the table for the summit, but it was clear to me, and I was there for some high-level meetings during Obama's visit, that the partnership agreements that I've described between the two countries on clean energy, energy efficiency, and greenhouse gas inventories were the bright spot and do indicate the potential for enormous mutual benefit. Both countries recognize, and they're moving forward on that. I was at a clean energy roundtable with two U.S. Secretaries, Commerce and Energy, and their counterparts in the Ministry of Science and Technology and the National Energy Administration. There were about 100 experts in the room, a lot from private industry from both countries, who were vying with each other to show how fast they were moving ahead on things like electric vehicle development and renewable energy. The excitement in that room was palpable. It was real. And I do believe that we're going to see, through implementation of these partnership agreements, enormous progress that may then move over, hopefully, to other areas of U.S.-China engagement.
Yeah. Questions? Yes, sir.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm from the Chinese Embassy in Washington, D.C. My name is Sung Guoshun. I'm the first secretary. I would like to ask a question. We appreciate the visit of President Obama to China and achieved a good result. And as you pointed out, that we have formed a partnership and cooperation on energy and climate change. I think that is beneficial for the climate and also energy security. I would want to ask whether do you have any specific suggestions or ideas to deepen the cooperation in this regard. As you know, we have set up Energy Efficiency Center, and we have a Memorandum of Understanding, and also we have a 10-year framework cooperation document. So how to deepen the cooperation and achieve concrete results from this cooperation? I think that it's very important. Thank you.
I can give three suggestions. Thank you for asking. One would be funding of the China U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center. When Secretary Chu came to China in June, the announcement was that each country would put in $7.5 million to fund the center. That is clearly insufficient. During the summit, it was announced that 10 times increase in the funding to $150 million total. But the money has to be found, and I think both countries are looking to the private sector for a lot of help on that. But really, the more funding that can be put into these agreements, the more productive they will be. Secondly, the EPA-NDRC agreement is still very much of a framework without too much detail. I believe it's very promising, but again, there's a lot of exchange that's gone on between EPA and the Ministry of Environmental Protection over the years in kind of improving capacity to monitor and verify conventional pollutants. So there's a lot of expertise there that's already been demonstrated that could be applied further to CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions. So again, just like the MOU that the two countries signed in July was much of a framework, and these agreements provide more detail, I think the next step for that one would be to provide some sort of annex or partnership that really puts some meat on the bones. And third, in order to be to really deepen and accelerate the cooperation, we believe that it's very important to make each of these agreements a public-private partnership, to utilize the expertise that exists in the private sector, the business community, but also at the state level in the U.S., which has led the way for many years on efficiency and renewables, to also take into account research institutes, utilities, and NGOs. The greater efforts that are made at this stage to utilize that expertise at all levels and not to make it just a government-to-government one, the more productive it will be.
I would agree with all of those points. I would add just one more, which is continued engagement at the highest levels, particularly between Copenhagen and Mexico City at the end of 2010, if that's the deadline that's set for concluding a final climate agreement. I think we'll see some very important progress in Copenhagen. But if the objective is, as I think it should be, a final legal agreement, there are some very difficult issues that will need to be worked through. And I think it will be important to maintain ongoing engagement at the leader level in order to deliver a successful conclusion to that second round of negotiation.
Yes, and at a high diplomatic level, I think that the discussions of what the U.S. and China are doing themselves on emissions needs to be brought more explicitly into the contributions that each make within a global framework for growth of concentrations of greenhouse gases that adds up to a solution, that adds up to the avoidance of dangerous climate change. When you put things in that framework, you start to ask harder questions about how much needs to be done. So I'd like the bilateral discussion of these things to be put more explicitly into a global framework with arithmetic integrity.
Yes, sir.
I'm Bert Keitel with the Atlantic Council. I have a two-part question. It's very encouraging to listen to the progress in process. And when I add up where it might go, just touching on Professor Gonneau's last comment, I don't yet see us getting past what are potential tipping points and real serious changes in the global environmental situation. And I'm, as a father of a young child, I'm happy to have standards and verification, but consequences also are important part of the process. And so I'm not particularly encouraged about the long-term prospects. So I just wanted, first part of the question is, am I overly pessimistic that in saying, hey, we're not getting there? The second one is, okay, if we're not, what's plan B? Because there have been a few mentions of adaptation and the enormous costs of adaptation, meaning what happens if one of those great three ice shelves eventually does slide into the ocean and many parts of the world go underwater. How do we organize the response to that? You think of the United Nations immediately, but is that the right place for it? So my two-part question is, one, are we really getting there? And the second is, if it doesn't look like it, which is what picture I get, what's plan B?
Well, plan B is so far inferior to plan A that focusing on it is not very encouraging. The mean of the expectations from the mainstream science suggests that the absence of effective mitigation will have consequences that will probably be catastrophic, involving disruption of human civilization on a scale that goes beyond anything we've had before. There's uncertainty about the science, but the uncertainty points to chances of it being even worse than that mean expectation, as well as chances that it will be better. So the uncertainty actually adds urgency to the case for case A, plan A. We are already too late to avoid significant consequences of climate change. The main scientific opinion says that we're feeling some of that rather painfully in Australia. The concentrations in the atmosphere through the standard 30-year lag through the role of aerosols are going to continue to increase for some time. We need a big effort to deal with the need for adaptation even under Plan A. Even with brilliant success in global mitigation, we'll be dealing with a lot of consequences. Mostly, I think, they involve getting markets to work better in a very wide range of spheres. It's the failure of markets that is part of the problem of climate change, but in adaptation, I think better markets can take us a long way. For example, in food trade, food going to have to be rapid changes of patterns of trade in food, and the current constipated global trading system for agriculture just can't handle it. That's just one example. There needs to be a huge increase in public investment in agriculture, plant breeding, and other matters related to adaptation. That's something that markets can't handle. Bob Zoellick, during the food crisis, the price crisis of the first half of last year, talked about doubling global public expenditure on agricultural research. Well, that was given some sort of lip service by the G8, but nothing much has happened. But the big question is how good a job we can do on Plan A, because if there is a melting of the Greenland ice sheet, if there is a substantial deglaciation of the Himalayas and the Tibetan plateau, then the consequences are truly horrific. I think we should recognize that we're not yet on trajectories that lead to a satisfactory Plan A, but good outcomes are not out of the question. The changes in the last couple of years, including in China and the United States, are of historic importance. The changes in trajectory that still need to be made are large, but the fact that we've made such changes in the last couple of years gives some hope that we'll be able to make the additional changes. I'll go back to the arithmetic of the three chapters of my climate change review that talked about the type of global deal that might add up to holding concentrations at 450 parts per million after a period of overshooting. That was strongly influenced by the state of play in the international discussions, which suggested it would be difficult for developing countries to enter binding commitments before 2020. That had been agreed at Rio and Kyoto and confirmed in Bali. I concluded that there was no prospect of avoiding high risks of dangerous climate change, more going beyond 450 parts per million and staying there, if we didn't shift on that, and so suggested a 10% reduction below business as usual in the developing countries as part of a global deal. Well, what China's doing adds up to about a 25% on the 40% improvement in emissions intensity and 30% on the basis of the 45% reduction in emissions intensity. So China's announced that it will do more than my arithmetic assumed. The U.S. is doing less, as Barbara mentioned. 17% from 2005 is only a very small reduction from 1990. Other developed countries have committed to much more. Japan, Europe, Australia, New Zealand, Korea. Nevertheless, that announcement is a huge shift in trajectory for the United States, and bedding that down, getting the legislation through the Senate, making that work, I think is the first step, and then as confidence grows that you can do that without knocking the stuffing out of the United States economy, greater ambitions can come into focus. So I wouldn't give up on a good plan A, partly because there's no plan B that's any good at all.
I'd like to just, follow up on that with a different take on what plan B might be. And in the U.S., the analogy would be the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990 that established the acid rain cap and trade program. My organization, NRDC, worked for 10 years to get those amendments into place. And the reason why it took so long was primarily because industry complained that the cost of compliance would be far beyond what we had estimated and what the industry could bear. And what we saw happened was shortly after the amendments were passed and the acid rain trading program went into effect, the industry and others noticed that the cost of compliance were far less. So again, we believe we may see that same, we will see that same kind of transformation in the debate. Once the climate change legislation is passed, that the cost of compliance will not only be much less than many are in the industry, of some industries, not all anymore, are claiming, but also in this case, the development of new jobs, clean energy industries that are going to bring a benefit, as well as a reduction in cost of oil imports and so forth. I think we shall see the same type of transformation in China once this carbon intensity target is put into the plans and actions, and provincial governors and mayors are rated in their job performance on how well they achieve it. I think China is also going to see, and with help in building capacity, that this is a benefit and will move towards more ambitious efforts. We just heard the other day, just the day after China announced its carbon intensity reduction target at a conference in Beijing, that China is soon going to announce a new renewable energy target. In the last few years, it has had to constantly revise its renewable energy targets upward as it achieves success. So that would be my plan B. Get the framework in place. Get the incentives in place that's going to develop, scale up rapidly of this new clean energy economy. And we're going to see tighter targets on both sides.
I think we have one right here. Gentlemen.
My name is Ben Fernandez, and I'm a graduate student. One of the questions that I had for you is, it seems as economies grow, they tend to shift often from very industry-heavy GDPs to GDPs that consist of much more in the way of services and so on. And now 40% seems like a huge number. I'm kind of curious, how much of that 40% are a result of the Chinese economy maturing and changing into things that are more service or potentially industries that are less pollution-producing, and how much of it is actually the industries that they have becoming more efficient and producing less pollutants?
It's hard to tease out what percentage of their carbon intensity target will be met through efficiency, increased efficiency, primarily in industry but also in buildings, how much will be achieved by the renewable energy targets, and how much through other methods. But I do agree with you that another area, in fact, maybe one of the biggest areas that's going to result in decreased carbon intensity in China, will be this transformation of its industrial structure away from the high energy intensive, high polluting industries towards a tertiary economy and less service economy. This is in China's long-term overall planning. It has, through these medium, long-term plans, the ability to carry out its industrial structure planning. It's already doing so in many respects. Things like tariffs, reducing or increasing them in order to slow the development of certain industries and promote the development of others. So this is, I think, going to be a key aspect. It's already happening, but the extent to which China can accelerate something that it already wants to do for other reasons is going to also help to reduce its CO2 emissions.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your presentations. Herbert Levin, is it realistic to expect the U.S. to, in fact, meet these improvement goals without a serious return and swift return to building nuclear power plants?
I think that one can certainly expect that nuclear will remain an important component of our energy mix, and that we may well see us moving forward for the first time in many decades with the construction of new power plants. I mean, I think one of the keys to getting a bill through the Senate will be some additional nuclear provisions. Now, over time, Congress has certainly afforded the nuclear industry all manner of support and subsidies to help get the industry kickstarted once again. What more can be done? I'm not sure. It's not a particular area of expertise for me. But I know that it's an area that will be closely focused on within the Senate. I do expect that there will be some additional nuclear provisions in the Senate bill and probably in the final bill. And I think that we can expect to see some growth of the nuclear sector in the decades ahead. But there are many other options available to us, including many that we've discussed in the Chinese context just now, in terms of efficiency and renewables and developing alternative sources.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm Margaret Pearson from University of Maryland, and I'd like to go back to the multilateral treaty for a moment. We've heard a lot today about the importance of the U.S. and China in spearheading the move toward Copenhagen. We've had some mention of the fact that Prime Minister Rudd is here today, presumably speaking about this, and a little bit of a mention of G77. But I'm wondering if the panelists could give us an sort of a lay of the land of what the coalitional behaviors are emerging as we move toward Copenhagen, who is bringing whom along, and how whether there's any surprises waiting for us as to other actors besides the U.S. and China, and what they may be likely to do, helpful or perhaps not so helpful.
I think we notice too little how much is happening and being contributed by some large developing countries other than China. I think the developments in China are very important and very positive. But the Indonesian president and his cabinet, since hosting the Bali summit, has taken the issue very seriously. It's a difficult political issue in that young democracy, but the government's kept a strong focus on the issue. The recent budget included funding for new technologies in the energy sector, development of geothermal power. Of course, in a number of the developing countries, the big issue is deforestation, and that issue has at least become the center of national policy focus in Indonesia. In Brazil and South Africa too, there have been important developments. South Africa are introducing an energy sector carbon tax a couple of years ago. One could say that the big developing countries have gone further than the US has at a national level at this stage, and that wasn't anticipated in the Kyoto and Bali agreements. India is a very important player, and India carries a fair bit of not very helpful ideological baggage in international discussions, tending to emphasize more the responsibility of developed countries. But even there, in response to movements elsewhere in the world, there's been some change of focus recently, so I'm hopeful that India too will play a positive role. Amongst the developed countries, people have been waiting for the U.S. Well, not waiting for the U.S. Commitments have been made, but everyone's been recognizing that the U.S. is the big piece of the jigsaw sitting in the middle, without which things can't come together. And if it looks as if the president's position is going to be supported by the Congress, although that U.S. position is much weaker than any other developed country, the U.S. at least legislating what will amount to an important change in trajectory will have a very positive outcome.
Well, I think we're out of time, and I want to thank all the panelists and the questioners from the floor. I would just like to make one final remark, because it's a subject near and dear to my heart, and that is, as we move towards Copenhagen and look at those of us that are profligate in our energy use and urge us all to cut our emissions of fossil fuels, and as we look to helping the emerging market countries with ameliorating their problems, we should also remember that there are 2 billion people in the world who have no access to commercial fuels as we know them, who use dung and agricultural residues and wood. And we shouldn't lose sight in Copenhagen that if those people have any hope for a brighter future, we have to find a way to bring them energy that will allow their societies to grow and develop in a way commensurate with the rest of the world. Thank you all very much for coming.
It's good to be here at the Brookings Institution for this terrific collaborative undertaking between the institution and ANU. And it's my honor to moderate the next panel. Following on the very specifically focused session we just did, looking at the global climate agenda, China and the United States, we're now going to turn to the broader topic of China's macro economy. And in particular, the panel is going to explore the extent to which it is changing, evolving, and in what directions. I should introduce myself first. Sorry, I'm Dan Rosen. I'm a visiting fellow at the Peterson Institute across the street, and I'm also the principal of Rhodium Group, which is a New York-based advisory practice. Before introducing the rest of the panelists, let me just say that the existing macro economy of China is the baseline from which we build all of our perspective and point of view about the adequacy of China's commitments on carbon, on other issues as well, environment, trade policy, development economic considerations. All of this starts from our understanding of what makes the Chinese macro economy tick today, how we understand it, how we think it's evolving and changing, where it's going in the world today. And how it operates is going to determine the traditional and the non-traditional outcomes and policy challenges that we have to confront in the future. It's always been a moving target. China's not stood still, certainly in the time, 15 or 16 years that I've been watching it change. And not really in the whole 10,000 days or 30 years since reform began at the end of the 1970s. So we're constantly reassessing what we think is going on and where we think it's taking us. The current moment may be a particularly volatile time in trying to gauge what's going on in the economy and what's going to happen next. I think about a question that was raised by a gentleman here in the previous panel concerning how much of China's carbon pledge would be achieved simply from the natural maturation of the economy, the natural structural adjustment that takes place as it moves through the industrial intense phase of its economic development to an era where the tertiary sector, the services sector of the economy, plays a bigger role. In terms of share of total economic activity. That time will absolutely come, and once China finally gets there, China, like the United States, will see 80% of its carbon use related to consumer activity rather than industrial activity, basically the inverse of where it is right now. But to the extent to which Chinese policy choice and policy intervention can change the mix today or in the medium term of the coming years, just because heavy carbon-intensive material is not made in China does not mean it's not made for China. China will need all the buildings. It will need all the petrochemical processing capacity. It doesn't necessarily have to be in China that all that capacity takes place. But carbon's going to be emitted somewhere, even if it's not in China, to meet the needs of a rapidly urbanizing population. So it's a very dynamic equation that doesn't just concern what's made in China. It concerns what needs to be made for China in the years ahead. Today, the questions we're going to focus in on, in terms of the macroeconomy, as I've described it, is the direction of policy reform changing? We've worked comfortably with the assumption, well, most of us, I think, on this panel have, for decades now, that though we don't like everything that issues forth from Chinese economic policy, by and large, we're moving in a market-oriented direction over time. That's been a fairly comfortable assumption. People are now debating that to a greater extent than in my previous memory, whether we're still moving in the direction we were comfortable we were moving in until recently. If there is a change taking place, is it for better or for worse? For better, in my parlance, would mean rebalancing toward a more efficient mix of economic activity inside China, and I think we're going to get into what that would mean in some detail. Or are we changing in a demarketized direction with the state clawing back a more active role for itself vis-a-vis the market? Nextly, was this precipitated, brought about by the global financial crisis? Or was this on track to happen anyway, and it was just coincidental to the crisis that brought the U.S. down a peg, if you will, and made China look like suddenly its industrial policy was much more effective at generating growth than it would have otherwise? Is it essentially a domestically driven policy change that's taking place, or is it essentially international, with China having to react to the new absence of external consumer demand for its product that forces an internal change back into the domestic economy? Which is the tail and which is the dog here? And finally, how should we or can we react to these changes if we decide that there is some significant change taking place in China that might affect our interests? To explore all these things, we have three terrific panelists here. First, Wing Tai Wu, right next to me. Well known to everybody here. This is one of his homes. He's non-resident senior fellow here at Brookings, professor of economics at UC Davis, originally from Malaysia, Yale and Harvard degrees in economics, an extensive lifelong track record of contribution on issues to do with China economic development that I don't even have time in the entire panel to go through with you here to get started. Nextly, Professor Song Li Gang from ANU, associate professor at the Crawford School of Economics and Government and director of the China Economy and Business Program at ANU. Last but not least, somebody who's very well known and well loved by everybody here in the Washington China community, Xiao Gang, who directs and runs the Brookings Tsinghua Center in Beijing. Almost all of us, I think, at one point or another have enjoyed his hospitality in Beijing, providing us a place to get together to discuss the critical issues with everybody who's important in Chinese government, Chinese academia, much of the private sector as well, plays an extraordinary role and has an extraordinary track record of work, the World Bank, Hong Kong University, the Hong Kong Securities Futures Commission, and other institutions. So we've got the right group of people, and I hope we've picked the right topics to talk about as well. Wing, let me ask you to start off for 10 or 12 minutes or so, give us some thoughts on this, and we'll move through and then come back to Q&A.
The list of questions that Dan just asked reflect a development in the press about concern about negative developments in the direction of Chinese domestic economic policy and a concern about changes of aggressive actions by China on the international economic front. I want to raise three points for discussions during the Q&A. My first point is that it is too early to say that there has been a reversal in the direction of China's economic reform, leading towards the resurgence of the state-owned sector at the expense of the private sector. The second point I'd like to raise is that the Chinese high level of activity on signing free trade treaties with all of its neighbors and investing heavily in Africa does not represent an intention to etch the U.S. out of its traditional sphere of influence. The third point that I want to raise for discussion is that I see the current macro stimulus package in China as one that would lead to great difficulties in the near future, and that unless the composition of the macro stimulus package is changed next year onwards, I fear it could lead to a slowdown in the long-term growth of the Chinese economy. On the first point, has there been a change in the direction of domestic economic policy? The New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Financial Times all point out that there's been a large expansion of the state sector. If you look at the growth of investments, it's been mainly led by the state sector. I think in order to understand why it is happening, one should recognize that as the state sector, as the most convenient tool for macro stimulus by the government that is available. Largely because how could you get a firm to enlarge its production capacity when demand for its goods are falling? How can you get a bank to increase its lending when domestic demand is falling and the international situation is so weak? Clearly, the state-owned companies are willing to undertake capacity expansion without a clear increase in demand for the output. And the state-owned banks, since it is not their money that they are playing with, are perfectly happy to make more loans to their friends and relatives and to them and to everybody else, since they would not be held responsible for the non-performing loans that might result. So the expansion of the state sector, as I said, is more a default than by design. And the implication is that when the negative consequences of these actions are recognized, they would be quite readily reversed, largely because the state has not decided to expand the state sector at the expense of the private sector. Of course, this is not to deny that the Communist Party of China is committed to maintaining a significant presence of the state-owned sector, especially in a role as the pioneers in as instruments of industrial policy, of pushing into new areas of industrial activities. That role is there and acknowledged, but I do not see, I think it's too early to think that the state wants to expand upon that role of the state, of the state-owned sector. The second point that I want to talk about was to do with whether the proliferation of free trade treaties in East Asia is to the detriment of the United States. One thing is for sure, the China sees the U.S. both as a strategic competitor and as a strategic partner. Strategic competitor in the economic sphere especially, and a strategic partner in the provision of global public goods, for example, on issues like climate change. So both aspects are present. But in most discussions on Chinese international economic policy, the emphasis has been on the strategic competitor aspect. It is to China's detriment if the United States were to leave the Pacific economies alone, largely because China is concerned about the reaction of Japan if the U.S. were to leave, and two, the possible rise in influence of the Soviet Union if the U.S. were to leave a vacuum. So it is not China's intention, as far as I can see, either for economic or for political interest, to etch the U.S. out of Asia. Why the proliferation of the signing of free trade treaties? This is largely the result of Doha being stuck for the last 5 years. All of East Asia wishes to increase its degree of integration into the global economy to enhance their economic development. And since the world at large could not move forward because of the paralysis over the Doha rounds, they have decided to move ahead among like-minded countries. All of Southeast Asia wants to go further than the Doha round. And they also at the same time want greater access to the growing Chinese market. So this proliferation of free trade treaties is quite natural. And at the last ASEAN Plus 6 meeting in Singapore, when Obama has clearly shown that the U.S. has no intention of leaving that part of the world either. And this is certainly not something which worried the Chinese. So I see the developments in the free trade areas as pretty much a development of continual globalization of economic activities. How about U.S. Chinese investments in Africa? Chinese investments in Africa reflect very much the continuation of China's export-led industrialization. To support its export-led industrialization, the Chinese has been willing to lend money to the U.S. consumers to continue buying Chinese goods. And since the U.S. consumer is unlikely to be spending the same way as before, thanks to our imprudent supervision of our financial system that has destroyed so much of our wealth, the U.S. economy is not going to bounce back very quickly. After all, the Federal Reserve has projected that unemployment in the U.S. will remain over 8% until after 2012. So given the fact that the U.S. consumer would not be spending as much before, so it's quite natural that China looks to Africa and is willing to lend Africa the money so that Africa could buy capital goods from China to industrialize and develop themselves. So instead of lending only to the U.S., which shows a decreased capacity to bear debt, they have now switched their lending to Africa. So this is not a new strategy. It's a continuation of a financing strategy to support in the export-led industrialization in China. And the third point which I wish to raise has to do with potential pitfalls in the current composition of the Chinese macro stimulus package. The first pitfall is that the Chinese stimulus package that has not taken sufficiently into consideration the growing protectionist sentiments in the world. I think the imposition of tariff on Chinese tires and on Chinese steel pipes by the Obama administration will be the beginning of the imposition on tariffs on Chinese goods in the European Union. And what the Chinese needs to do is to be aware that the paralysis of the Doha round, the reasons behind it, have escalated. And all of it has to do with the fact that economic growth in EU and the United States. It's going to be slower in the next 2-3 years. And so what the Chinese really need to do is to greatly increase its imports as the way to reduce its large current account surpluses. The idea of China cutting its exports in order to reduce its surplus is certainly inferior to maintaining its exports but increasing its imports. And this is something that can is well within China's ability to do. For example, the one usual comment I get from visiting Chinese delegation is that, what else can we buy from the United States, right? There's so many planes we can buy, and you wouldn't sell us nuclear technology, you wouldn't sell us advanced scientific equipment. I feel that part is really missing the point. China could import a lot more in non-traditional areas. For example, importing education is something that China could greatly expand on. Sending students abroad and beefing up its own education system by hiring the newly graduated PhDs of 2010 and who would have difficulties finding job in the United States. This would certainly be a great transfer of human capital to China that would certainly strengthen its basic capacity to grow and to innovate. So that would be part of it. And the other thing that China should do for its own good, I think, is to resume the process of exchange rate appreciation. Not that I believe that the exchange rate appreciation would reduce overall U.S. deficit. It would only reduce bilateral U.S.-China deficit. I say this from the experience of the U.S. beating down on Japan to make Japan appreciate its exchange rate from 250 yen to 125 yen. If you look at that period, what you do see is a shrinkage of the bilateral U.S.-Japanese trade imbalance, but the U.S. overall trade imbalance stayed remarkably unchanged. Why? Japanese goods were more expensive, so we bought more from the rest of Asia to make up for what we did not buy from Japan. And Japan sent its capital to Southeast Asia to industrialize Southeast Asia to service the U.S. market from there. So the yuan appreciation would certainly show that the Chinese are sharing the share of the pain, but it would not make us any happier. And there is something which I should mention. Protectionism is something that not only the China should be concerned about, but also the United States. There are many things that we can do, one of which is to strengthen our social safety nets. We have the weakest social safety nets among the G7 countries. And I think that in an age of globalization, where switching of jobs is much more frequent than before, a strong social safety net is very important to maintain domestic consensus for continued globalization. So the protection of the world trade system rests not just on China, but also on the United States. The second pitfall in the current Chinese macro stimulus package is that it is creating a trade-off between full utilization of existing capacity against the generation, against the maintenance of a high, sustainable, long-term growth rate. What are the instruments of macro stimulus? Investment by state-owned companies and large loans by state-owned banks. Both, a lot of this is used to generate activities that are not particularly labor-intensive. For example, a $1 billion bridge will employ less people than $1 billion worth of manufactured goods. So what China needs to do to employ all these migrant workers who's been laid off is to set up conditions to enable them to start their own businesses. And this is where the Chinese system is very poor in doing, in nurturing small and medium enterprises established by entrepreneurs. And this setting up of small, medium banks would be very difficult if the rural sector is not able to provide some form of collateral at the beginning in order to get the process of financial intermediation going. And this is where land privatization is overdue. I think land privatization has to come to China to produce the collateral for the migrant workers to be take out additional loans. And with it, the acceleration of urbanization, which is a fundamental driver of China's economic growth, would be accelerated, the privatization of land, and hence the ending of the household registration system, which ties the peasants to the land. The third point that I want to talk about is that there's too much complacency about inflation in China because they look at the West and they see the same amount of increase in high power money, but yet the absence of inflation in the United States and EU. If you look at the increase in the high power money in China and the United States, they are of the same order of magnitude. But given the difference in circumstances, this explosion of high power reserves is not inflationary in the US, but it is inflationary in China. Why is it not inflationary in the US? It is because what the US banks have experienced is a massive loss of bank capital, which make them unable to meet the capital adequacy ratio. So in order to meet the capital adequacy ratio, they have to dump their loan portfolio and move on to cash, in which they don't have whole capital. And what the Federal Reserve operations has been is essentially to allow the conversion of those loans to cash at the bank. And so these high power reserves cannot lead to additional loans by the banks because it is to repair the balance sheet. Whereas in the case of China, the balance sheets were already cleaned up around 2004, and so this additional addition of stimulus would naturally create additional aggregate demand, which is why you see this burst of revival in the stock market and a revival of the asset bubble in housing. So I think that it is very important for China to avoid these three potential pitfalls I've talked about, and they would require a change in the composition of its macro stimulus package.
Excellent, Wing. Thank you. So I think I'm hearing the first vote for not an intentional change in a demarketized direction, but a sort of unintentional movement of convenience that will have unintended consequences that will tend to make this redirection somewhat short-lived and not a long-term trend. But we'll come back and tease out all the details here. Dr. Song?
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. Thank you for the opportunity. Are China's growth strategy and international policy changing? And the answer is yes. In my presentation, I would like to emphasize that there are some opportunities for China to doing so, but at the same time, there's also constraints and China is facing. In the past 30 years, the growth is on average is about nearly 10% per annum. And China right now is the third largest economy in the world. Perhaps by this year, China will replace the United States and to become the largest manufacturing powerhouse in the world, perhaps also the largest trading nation in the world. So why now that the model can continue? It seems to be going so well in the past. The reason why is the problem is because of the growth model is basically driven by three factors from the demand side: investment, net export, and consumption. The consumption play a very much less important role in enhancing growth. So mainly the growth of China is driven by investment as also as export dependency. Why China has so obsessed about export in the way that is the we have to understand the background of that. In the past 30 years, China's almost converting or transforming more than 200 million people from a rural area into urban area. Majority of them actually are being absorbed in the most dynamic and competitive export sector. So the export sector play an important role in internal transformation of China. So that's why the government is very adamant in terms of adjusting the exchange rate policy. It's because of that affects the millions of people's of employment in those dynamic sector. Well, the SOE sector, because of reform, they are shedding kind of workers. So therefore, you know, the export sector play a quite important role in that regard. The second issue related to that one is the overcapacity. And the state-owned sector has a kind of a very strong motive, of course, also powered by the local government and enhancing growth. So the lot of issues is about the savings and investment imbalances. But the state sector has a very good position in terms of regenerating the resources for investment. And again, the export dependence ratio also related to the overcapacities and plays hand in hand. Give you one example about the steel industry. Perhaps by next year, the steel capacity in producing steel products will reach about 700 million tons. And the domestic demand for steel products roughly about 500 million. So you can see a huge gap there. But again, in China, you can see it everywhere. You can see the steel mill is still being built. So these two issues also highlighting because of the high, the importance of exporting the manufacturing products. In recent years, we can see that is the China start about until about 3 years ago, China is a net importer of steel products. But since 2007, China now becomes a net exporter of steel products. That is one of the reasons. So the global imbalances, the key of that is to a shifting the expenditure from a deficit country to a surplus country. But however, in case of China, they still have some difficulties. I'll list four or five factors. Number one is about per capita income. Right now, it is about 300,000 for China. But in terms of the frontier, if you can look at the most developed countries like United States, compared with that one, China by 2008 is just about 13% in terms of reaching the frontiers. In terms of urbanization, China right now is about 45%. But again, it's below the world average. So there's a continued the room for China to grow. Number three is about investment. On average, the investment ratio to GDP is about 38%. That is very high in terms of the international comparison. However, if you in terms of the investment per capita, China is very much lower, and it's much lower than the average of the OECD country. In 1978, it's about 2%. In 2007, it's only 10%. So it's not too much capital being invested. It's insufficient. And so China needs to invest more in terms of capital. So that's the kind of a paradoxical things. In terms of energy intensities, and again, it's a similar situation. So this is the background in which China is required to adjust this domestic economy in terms of reducing the share of investment and increasing the share of consumption in total GDP. So here we are. In the book, we make a distinction about export orientation and export dependencies. In case of we just draw a simple chart, and taking a country as a share of a total output in the world total against the share of export in total world total export. So if it is the path goes along the 45-degree lines, that means it's more or less it's balanced. Here in this case, we're just looking at a few countries and make this kind of a comparison. In the United States case, it's actually offer a model. Towards the end of the 19th century, United States is a very much open economy in terms of trade and investment. However, towards the first decade of the 20th century, U.S. take a very decisive kind of a shift in terms of strategy by lowering that dependence ratio, increasing the domestic market, and that strategy actually become a very important. You can see it very clearly. That line is above the 45 degree line, and then this comes down after that. That's one example. The other example is Japan. Japan in 1960s and the 70s, it's very much a kind of relatively balanced. But however, towards the 1980s, end of 1980s, Japan moving very rapidly towards export dependence. That means they go beyond 45 degree lines. Korea, the same thing. So it makes it very vulnerable to external economy. China is still below the 45 degree lines, but however, it's rapidly approaching. The export dependence ratio for China is about 35%. So in the way China does need to adjust, following the pattern or the strategy of the United States about 100 years ago, but certainly not example of Korea and Japan in recent decades. So in case of adjustment, it's not just the issue of exchange rate policy. I think a lot of people outside China think that is that's the key issue. But importantly, is the financial sector reform, the capital market, and importantly, is the relationship between a government and SOEs. Because all the money is collected by SOE as a profit, is retained by SOE rather than handing over to the owner of the asset, which is the government. So therefore, the enterprises have plenty of money to reinvest. And again, it's a local government reform and et cetera. So that is the issue. And on the low carbon growth, there's a lot of discussion in the previous panel. I just want to emphasize the one issue, which is the regional dimensions. We cannot treat China as a single country because there's a vast regional growth differences or income differences. The richest province and the poorest province, the income gap in terms of per capita income is about 9 times. So therefore, according to the Kuznets yield curve, inverted yield curve, when you talk about the low carbon and all the emission reduction with the very poor provinces and against the rich provinces, their priority will be very different. So that highlighting some kind of difficulties for China to comply with that one. So on the FDI, there's Win already mentioned briefly. I think it is there's several important hypotheses associated with China's going out. And the number one is about market seeking. And number two is about efficiency seeking. And third one is about resource seeking or the acquisition of a strategic assets. In case of China, more or less is a focus on the final one, which is about resource strategy. And also, Win mentioned about very importantly, because of China in the process of readjusting its growth strategy, so therefore, exporting is become so important. So therefore, it tried to link the FDI from China with the export activities. And internally, we can see the drivers for the growing of FDIs. I think importantly, the so-called capital market imperfections. Because of the imperfections, so the investors coming from China, the funds can be made available at a lower market rate because of the market capital imperfection. So therefore, give a tremendous advantage for the investors from China. The second advantage is about the state ownership. This, of course, is well known story about the flexibility and etc. Of course, the third one is about institutional factors, which is the government in China also in a way that is promoting that the investment. So on the part of international side, I think two issues are all important. One is about ethical issues. The other is about accountability issues. So both government and the firm levels can play a quite important role in influencing the behavior of investors from China. Finally, I think we already touched upon the thorny issue about a rising protectionist in China. So to conclude in the way that is what is the path towards that global adjustment? I think International Monetary Fund has two scenarios. One is that is a cut of a current account deficit of the United States by half in about 4 or 5 years' time. The other one is a more more or less is still worsening the situation. But their projection seems to show that the global growth rate is still more or less remain the same, roughly about 3.5%. That's the global growth, which is not bad. But however, there's uncertainties about what happened to China and what will happen to the global adjustment. So the uncertainty associated with the growth path in the next 4 or 5 years. So in a way, whether we can actually achieve a quick result in terms of resolving that global imbalances. It seems to be a bit of unknown. So in the way that is the, let me just emphasize, it's not just a single issue about renminbi exchange rate. There's a lot of other issues internally, especially in terms of domestic reform, especially taking account about the regional dimension of growth in China, and also an important issue about the trajectory of our economic structural changes towards a high value added and towards the service sector of the economy. And also the importance of, I think the previous panel emphasized the international cooperation in the way to allow the technology be introduced into China to have a kind of a leapfrogging rather than follow the traditional pattern of growth. But however, given the wider regional disparities, we can see, at least we can foresee that it's just so complicated because the rich provinces and the poor provinces. So we can see probably for the foreseeable future, the structure of industrial structure of China probably will produce the goods as a wider range of a spectrum. So you can see there's a high level, high tech industry, but at the same time, because of the poor provinces, they can take over at a lower end. So that's the complication in confronting the global adjustment, perhaps also confronting the emission reduction the target. Success or failure of China's adjustment will not only have impact on China, but also on the global economy at large. Thank you.
Okay. So, I hear a view of the Chinese economy as having diminishing marginal efficiency of business as usual. The model we know is generating more and more disappointing results, but I don't get the sense that beyond diagnosing the problem, there's a dramatic policy inflection has started yet. We're still talking about what it'll take to get the kind of changes we need to see underway. Xiao Gang.
Thank you, Daniel. I think that during the last few years, the Chinese policymakers has come to realize that the Chinese growth model has serious problem, and they really want to fix it. But the trouble is that it's not that easy to fix to change the model. I spent almost 3 years in Beijing. Every time I met with senior officials, the question always is that, someone from embassy raised the question this morning, asked me that, do you have any good way, to fix that, So that kind of attitude is just amazing. They really want to fix the problems, but the problems are very, very serious. I think there are three problems. Number one, the wage of Chinese workers are so low, especially compared to United States wage. It's average migrant worker earns only $120 to $150 a month. How to increase their income? And the second challenge is that the price for energy, for land, for natural resources are so low. Partly because the local governments, they are competing for foreign direct investment, competing for development. So they are giving land freely, to build factories, build exports, to produce exports. Also the price of electricity, water, all those are very low because traditionally under central planning, the government set prices, usually very low. So that is a very difficult challenge, how to raise the price of energy, of resources, of land, so they will not be wasted. For example, to build all the overcapacity steel mills. And the third challenge is actually similar to what we see here in the United States. The money is so cheap. There's plenty of money available in China, especially now. Just last few months, there are so many foreign investors coming to China, try to invest in China. In a way, some of them short-term, some of them actually long-term. Because looking around the world, there are no other places to invest. You know, the other countries have negative growth rate, but China has more than 8%. And if you actually visit China, you will see those growths are actually real. So that's really the challenges which China is faced with. And on the first challenge, the income is so low. And because the income is so low, so consumption as share of GDP is very low. A lot of income goes to the state-owned enterprise. The state-owned enterprise does not pay dividend, cannot pay high salary. The government actually controls the limits, the salary. And the state-owned enterprise, some of them are listed in the stock exchange. When the price goes up, those capital gains does not transform into purchasing power, consumption, because nobody is sensitive to those increases in wealth. Just sitting in the government's book. How to fix these problems? I think fundamentally, we need China to grow, to invest more, to increase income. But we need China to invest in efficient projects, not overcapacity. Projects which will increase Chinese consumption in the future, if not at the present. Saving is for the consumption in the future. Nothing wrong with saving. So the problem is Chinese people want to consume in the future, but what? You know, we should build the future. So there is a misunderstanding among the policymaking communities that the Chinese investment is too high. It's not too high. And if you look at the situation in China, when China builds these high-rise buildings, you have to put all the concrete and steel, you know, on the land in 3 months, and then the building will last for 100 years, even 200 years, right? And this is something very different from the kind of investment in a mature economy, right? So, I think the last question I want to mention briefly is that about the exchange rate, because some of panelists that mentioned it. The Chinese policymaker realized that China needs to change its export-oriented growth model, but it faces serious difficulties. For example, if China starts to appreciate its currency like it did during 2005 and 2008, when you have a sure bet that the currency is going to increase in value, you attract massive speculative investment from overseas Chinese. And that becomes a trouble, you know, creates bubble in property market and in stock market. And when the government try to, if they want to raise interest rate to deal with the bubble, you also attract massive inflows of capital. And how to deal with these problems. And the policymakers right now are so much concerned about what we call carry trade, you know, on dollar. In the past, we have carry trade on yen, because U.S. interest rate is zero. If you borrow U.S. dollar and then go to China to invest, or you just simply deposit in the banks, you get a very high return. And how to deal with these problems? You know, Chinese financial sector is actually still not matured and not developed. So all these are serious challenges. But the government realized that for whatever reasons, for the short run and even for the medium run, you know, the objective is to increase consumption and also increase investment to make sure the employment will grow, the economy will grow, even at the risk of some bubbles in the property market and the stock market. The government actually is spending a lot of effort in targeting speculation, in, you know, enforcing the regulation. For example, the bank capital adequacy requirement during the last few years was enforced very rigorously and actually is beyond 8%. And also in the stock market, tremendous effort put into the how to deal with the insider trading, how to make the market more transparent. So I would say that especially after the global financial crisis, the Chinese government realized that it needs to deal with some of the substantive challenges. But unfortunately, the time and efforts of the policymakers are actually distracted by a lot of macro issues, exchange rate, all this trade protectionism, which I think is unfortunate, because if Chinese government can focus more on reforms, for example, privatize the state-owned enterprise, liberalizing the effect market price, land reform, and many other financial reform. Financial reform, the government actually decided after the global financial crisis, the Chinese authorities decided to build Shanghai into an international financial center by 2020, basically set a timeline for the liberalization of the capital account. I think that is shows the determination of the government to really reform its financial sector, because if you want to build an international financial center, basically you decide to open the market to the international community. So in that sense, you know, we can see, I saw a very dramatic change in the policy directions, you know, away from the past 30 years. I will stop here. Thank you.
Excellent. Terrific. All right, that gets us into our discussion here. Let me start by observing that all three panelists put the behavior of China's financial system right at the heart of the matter in terms of what needs to change, or to some extent maybe what's already changing, without so much intentionality that the banking system should be giving all of the lending and wherewithal in the country to the heavy industrial sector. That's what the financial system has tended to do for a variety of complex reasons. And the heavy industrial sectors that get all this money, the big five of them, together, nationwide, employ merely 14 million people in a labor pool of 780 million. There are more service sector jobs in Guangdong alone than adding up all the steel, aluminum, cement, plate glass, and petrochem in China, nationwide. So you don't create any jobs by doing this. We have huge amounts of missing economic activity that should be given comparative advantage taking place in China, but which are not taking place. If I'm hearing all the panelists right, and I'm pretty sure I am, it's not enough to say the financial system should provide more access to capital to small and medium-sized labor-intensive companies. Offering them equal access is not going to do it. Separate but equal will be inherently unequal. We need affirmative action for the private sector in China. Is that what it's going to take to break through the political economy that puts all the resources at the disposal of the SOEs instead of these other higher potential industries? Dr. Song, you want to start with that?
I think a typical example right now is just about the relationship between a state-owned and a non-state sector. And we see in the past, especially since the second half of the 1990s, there's a massive privatization going on. So right now, it's just about, in terms of GDP, the non-state sector is just accounted for about more than 60%. In terms of industrial value added, it's more than 80% of total economy. However, if you look at the structure of the lendings, so the non-state sector is receiving only less than 20%, something like that, from the official or the formal financial sector. This mismatch highlighting the importance existing in the current financial or banking sector reform. And in the middle of this crisis, we know that the government has the largest stimulus package put in place. And of course, because of the slowing down of growth of export, and so therefore all this majority of the money is actually put into the infrastructure and et cetera. So people are really concerned about whether there's a crowding out of the private investment. And in fact, Xiaogong mentioned about the property, the bubbles and et cetera. Because of lack of the investment in the real economy, because of the slowing down of export and et cetera. So put money, including both state and the non-state sector, into the real estate sector. So this is the problem. So therefore, changing that will depends on many issues and probably will takes time. But we know in theory and in the past 30 years, the reform experience tells us it's actually moving towards the non-state sector, moving towards a more market-driven economic activities will be more efficient and in the long run. So China is actually a kind of a juncture there. And the crisis makes it more complicated because of government-driven investment behaviors. But however, government should quickly change that strategy towards how to generate the all-created opportunity to help the private sector to invest more to keep that balance. The fundamental things, again, back to the banking and the financial system reform, and also the reform of the relationship between a government and the state-owned enterprises.
It's probably not going to just be offering additional money to the private sector. It's going to mean taking money away from somebody to make it more accessible to somebody else. Somebody who's paying 5% for money now compared to a private sector paying 15 to 25%, they're going to meet in the middle and there's going to be less for the SOEs. So it's going to be painful. It's not going to be a painless process of adjusting who gets the resources for growth. Wang, in your remarks, you noted that the past 12 to 18 months have actually seen a shift of resources to the state sector, not making resources more accessible to these new growth areas, but kind of going the other way. And this leads to some of the pitfalls you see. Is that just a temporary phenomenon that will naturally correct itself back in the right direction? Or does there need to be a really painful big bang of a shift in incentive in the financial structure here to start moving hundreds of billions of dollars to other industries?
I think there would have to be correction for the simple fact that this channeling of funds from the state banks to the state enterprises is resulting in a large amount of overcapacity. So, but are they going to do something about it? My prediction is that there's no need to do anything about it for as much as 2 years. And it is unlikely that the government would do much about it, large for two reasons. One is the feeling of political vulnerability that this government has about its political legitimacy. So it sees the full utilization of existing capacity as very important to its political survival. The second reason is that we have now entered into the lame duck period of the Hu Jintao administration. His high point, if he had to do anything, would have been in the last 2 years. But now he's at the end of his regime, and he's faced with a collapsing world economy. So he's more concerned about capacity utilization right now than about putting the country on the road to a higher sustainable growth rate. Look at what some of the measures involved. One of them would be providing a level playing field for the private sector. And that would inevitably mean a shrinkage of the state-owned sector. And the problem with the state enterprises is not just that they are inefficient, they are also indispensable instruments of political patronage for the government. Basically, it's an allocation of spoils among the political elites. Different families have different industrial sectors. And so when you talk about reform, in this case, the industrial sector, you are talking about whose ox should we first gall? And it's not Boo. And you look at the question of land reform. Land reform actually threatens the very fundamental basis of control of the countryside. How can the party maintain such great control over the countryside? It's through the redistribution of land. If you don't listen to me now, well, when it comes to redistributing land, you get the one that is up the hill rather than next to the river. and let us watch water flows uphill. So
right.
Land privatization threatens some very key institutions of control. And when we talk about unleashing the private sector for growth, I think that is something that they know, but however, it's not the politically expedient thing to do unless there is quite a serious systemic crisis.
Mm-hmm.
So it, in a way, a stumbling of the system is what that could lead to the movement towards better economic policies. And I see that this stumble would not come about internally, at least for the next 18 months, but what could provide the stimulus is the protectionist reactions in the West.
Okay.
And well, that, however, could lead to a backlash that could be adverse to market reforms.
It doesn't sound to me like this is an orderly process of rebalancing in the right direction in your point of view then. Xiaogang, do you share that? You're a little more optimistic that policymakers have a clear diagnosis and prognosis for how to move us ahead?
Well, I think we have to put this into perspective. You know, during the last 30 years, the Chinese economy has been privatized from like 100% owned state, state-owned, to like now only about 30% GDP generated from the state sector. So that trend is continuing, you know, with the old foreign investor companies in China competing fiercely. But the problem is, you know, they are about 150 really big state-owned enterprises which are making profit because they are in the monopolized sector and the so-called strategic sector. And those companies, just like some we discussed, they increase capacity, you know, and sometimes, you know, nobody can control them. So I think it's right that we should push China towards reform of those sectors, those companies. And if you look at it from the my talk with the officials, they actually want to reform it. If you talk to the State Asset Supervision and Management Commission, they want to list all these companies. They want to privatize all these companies. But the process takes time. China listed the, all the major banks, but still is 70-80% owned by the state. So I think that there is a long way to go for China to reform. But I would also say that the market force in China are much, much stronger than what we discussed here about the state control today. If you look at the market in China, it's fiercely competitive, except in a few sectors. As China continue to open with pressures from the international community, I'm pretty confident that in a few years' time, you know, 5-10 years' time, looking back, we will see dramatic changes in this strategic sector.
So there are market forces at work that were not present in previous resurgent moments of the state that should help get us back to balance. Let me turn to the to you now. We have about 15 minutes. Please keep your questions as short as possible. Let us know who you are and who'd like to go first. Sir, right here in the middle.
Should we take a number of questions?
Let's see how it goes, yeah, if we start.
Pardon. Eric McVaden again, Institute for Foreign Policy Analysis. This may be a naive question with respect to the country's U.S. and Chinese stimulus packages, but I wonder if there has been or if there should be coordination or maybe not synchronization, but some sort of a consultation about implementing them. What I mean by that is that, for example, the stimulus packages could involve U.S. investment in green technology in China, or U.S. and Chinese investment in North Korea that might have a spinoff for Dongbei, for Northeast China's Rust Belt or something of that sort. Is that too naive to hope for?
One comment on that, whether there's some low-hanging fruit to coordinate stimulus better on our two sides. Who wants to take a crack at it?
Well, there was an attempt at coordination to prevent the rise of protectionism. This was true in the October 2008 summits here in D.C. And by the time they met again in March 2009, what has happened? 17 out of the 20 countries had implemented protectionist policies, according to the World Bank.
What about stimulus, though? What, in terms of government spending, this
stimulus, I think when it was done, it should have been certainly done simultaneously, because sequential stimulation would not be sustainable individually, largely because it caused current account deficits that makes it unsustainable. But right now, we are not in the face of too much simultaneous stimulus because the country conditions are quite different. For example, the Australians are in the midst of pulling back, and the Europeans have seen their economy improving, so Europeans are not on board for stimulus. And the Obama administration, given what that is projected for the healthcare reform, for it to talk about further stimulus, I think is a very difficult task to do politically. The chance for simultaneous fiscal stimulus has come and gone.
Probably now the most important thing is coordinating our exit from stimulus to make sure that we don't game each other to try to maximize our own interests there. There's a question toward the back, gentleman. Yeah, with the blue shirt, go ahead. No, you with the glasses and mustache, yep. Yeah.
I'm Nimai Mehta with American University. Just on the possibility for reform and what the party is able to achieve in China, the party is increasingly concerned, or for some time has been, about corruption, especially at the local level and in the provinces. And I'm just wondering whether that gives them, that concern with corruption gives them an easy segue into addressing some of these reform issues, especially on land and such.
Dr. Song or Xiaogang?
Well, I think the Chinese, the Communist Party has always been trying very hard to fight corruption. And they are actually some progresses. If you look at the high-profile, high-level people get fired and sentenced. But the issue is more institutional in the sense that if you have state-owned enterprise, you know, you are going to get someone trying to, you know, put some money in their own pocket. So I think it's a long-term effort. Yeah.
I'm Li Chen here with the China Center. Thank you for the excellent panel and discussion. And my question is about the land reform, since Wing, you know, talked about a few times, but also welcome others to comment. As we know that 2 years ago, particularly in 2007 and the first part of 2008, the Chinese leadership talked a lot about the land reform. It was the theme of the major meeting. Sounds like Hu Jintao and Wen Jiabao wanted to, you know, put their legacy on that issue area. Now the question is whether, as we know that the land reform is largely on hold, my question is whether it's related with the global financial crisis that make Chinese leaders very nervous to pursue, or related with the internal fightings. And no matter what, do you think that the Chinese leadership will return to that policy in the near future? Because most people believe that unless China adopts a real land reform, China can never have the domestic demand economy, but there are also challenges overwhelming. So what's your assessment about are we going to see that China will accelerate the land reform in the next year or two?
I think that it would be politically very astute for this leadership to raise land reform as a stimulus measure. Because, for one, it would allow the development. But it cannot be done in isolation. Two other things needs to be done besides land reform in order to promote it as a stimulus measure. One is to allow the establishment of private small medium banks. And second, the provision of public housing in urban areas. The big housing bubble that we see in China, a lot of it is for low-cost housing. But there's a lot of vacancy in the low-cost housing, largely because the low-cost housing is still too expensive for people who newly come from the countryside. What China should be doing is what the way that Singapore and Hong Kong started at the very beginning, which is you rent out the public housing for 10 years and after that sell it to the resident, the people who occupied it. So in order to get people to move readily out from the countryside, land privatization and the end of the household registration system, and this would unleash accelerated urbanization, which is a big pent-up domestic demand. Things like decoration of homes is extremely labor-intensive, mm-hmm. much more labor-intensive than building a bridge or building a road.
Dr. Song, you want to add on this?
The land management system in China is very much focused on the issue of underpricing of land. So because of the land is very much undervalued, so it causing us several problems. Number one is about the real estate bubbles, etc. So because of the local government and together with the developers can acquire the land very cheaply. So therefore, you send, it's not a market prices when you purchase. So therefore, you can sell it with high profits. Of course, there is some kind of a justification for government doing that because of they need that money as a source of their revenues. The second issue about is that because the land value is undervalued, so farmers actually don't care much about the fertility of the land for a long time. So the damage to the land in the past 20 years is actually much worse, I heard, compared with the thousands of years of land cultivation because of the market is not there. The third one is about undervalued land is actually related to the income distribution issue. Farmers' income as a part of the reason is the kind of a low consumption in China. So because they don't have the kind of access to that very high valued the asset. So therefore, they're highlighting the importance of reform in the land system in China.
An example, this is an example of the reality that it's not for want of attractive policy options that China hasn't shifted the model more dramatically. There are lots of very high return reforms that could be undertaken that would be effective. Exactly. It has to do with winners and losers, political economy issues, that's that we haven't seen more fulsome reform, I think, to date. There's a question right here, though. Yes.
Thank you very much for your discussion, and I'm very honored to be here. And my name is Kun Dong. I'm a graduate student from Sophia University, Tokyo, Japan. And my question concerns about the Chinese stimulus package. As we all know, with the decreasing of export in China, whether or not China can pass this economic crisis mainly depend on the domestic expansion of domestic consumption. And just a few days ago, at an economy 2009 economy conference, the government specifically point out a new idea for next year that is to focus on expanding the consumption ability of lower level households and individuals. And I would like to have your opinion here. And do you think it's practical, or are you positive about this strategy or not?
Last question. So if everybody wants to take a minute to kind of pull it together on that note.
Yes, I think it could be done, but it would not be the easiest thing politically for the simple reason. It caters directly to the state construction lobby. If you build schools, you build hospitals. But it's very hard to generate rents to them if you send many more qualified teachers and many trained doctors that are there. In other words, hardware investment generate rents for members of the elite, whereas software investments, which some people term consumption, I do not see better education and better health care as consumption. I see it as investments. And those do not generate the same kickback to the entrenched interest.
Building a low-cost housing is as a part of the strategy is controversial. And many people, many scholars point out that it's actually a distortionary, even though on the social and the welfare kind of a ground, and it's kind of justified. So the reason why is that is because that relating to the housing market, the buildings and the cost and benefit, and et cetera. So it's not that simple that it's just a building house and people can afford it, and but also have to consider about the market forces behind that.
I say, just very simple, the objective is to increase employment because employment really is the key and also allow wage growth. And the wage growth means there will be inflation. So the government is actually tolerating some certain amount of inflation. Already the government adjusted very dramatically the minimum wage upwards. So the old money supply is actually partly will fit into the inflation, and which in a way will raise wages. So I think employment is the number one priority for the government, and that is actually working quite well. And the unemployment of migrant workers already restored to the pre-crisis levels.
Let me tell you what I distill and take away from what we've heard here this morning. I get a sense that there's quite a lot of understanding about the fundamental nature of the problems that need adjusting in China, what rebalancing needs to include in order to be effective for long-term Chinese growth. I get the sense that these concerns that a darker set of forces of the state thinking it can somehow be the engine of the growth for the future is not such a concern among our panelists as it might be in some political circles in Washington and elsewhere, but that the response to the challenge, as we understand it, has so far been very piecemeal, very much a mix of halting steps to do the right thing for these new growth areas of the economy, combined with overshadowed, really, by urgent, old-fashioned steps to provide for growth in the very near term. So, Wing, as you said to start it out, it really is too soon to make a definitive statement about where this is headed. But certainly, China hasn't fixed or gotten its house in order yet. I think we can say that with clarity. Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking the panelists.